Welcome to episode 49 of the Wilder Podcast. In this episode, we are joined by Claire Hill, farmer, educator, and pioneer. Together, we explore the role of regenerative farming, the importance of shifting mindsets, and the real-world experiments occurring on Plankton Farm. Chloe, good evening.
Good evening, Tom.
Oh my goodness. It's a new year, isn't it?
Happy 2026.
In February.
But there is lots of excitement in the podcast 2026. We've recorded some fantastic interviews. There's lots to look forward to.
If anyone is new, we are Chloe and Tom. We're husband and wife. And we've not only have the Wilder Podcast, but we've got the Grange Project as well, which is our attempt at having a positive influence on the world by restoring nature to an 80-acre farm in kind of southeast Wales. But more than just that, we're looking at ways of how we produce more food, how we support more sustainable businesses, and how we engage more people in the conversation and the education around the importance of nature. And what we normally do at the start of the podcast is give a quick update as to the things that have happened around the Grange Project in the last few weeks. So Chloe, over to you.
I think the most significant moment has been our lovely community day that we had in the middle of January. And at this time of year, you really do get the special forces of volunteers coming out.
So true.
It is definitely wet. It's definitely muddy. It was pretty windy and cold, but we achieved a lot, which was fantastic. We did some slightly unusual planting in the polytunnel.
I wouldn't know. I was outside in the wind and the rain. Overseeing, obviously, not getting stuck into the dirty bit.
Yeah, sorry, Tom. We were feeling quite smug in the tunnel, in there as we were protected from the elements. And although the rain did sound quite loud on the roof.
Oh, yeah, that's terrible.
No, we were having a lovely time planting some slightly exotic species in the tunnel.
Go on, then. What were they?
So we planted kiwi, passion fruit, nectarines, cherries, peaches. So it's going to be like a tropical buffet in there in the next few years.
Well-known native breeds.
Well, that's the port in a polytunnel. It extends your season and allows you to grow things that perhaps you wouldn't be able to do outside. So yeah, really excited to see how they develop in the next few years.
And have you, because I poked my head in, so you've, it's still the kind of permaculture principles with trees in between and roses heads?
Sort of. Because the shape of the polytunnel, you can't quite do the agroforestry in between the beds. So we've got trees in the corners with shrubs, and then down the central line we've got this like strip of vines. So I'm hoping it'll feel quite jungle-esque as you walk in the long term, as the vines grow up through the center and then across the roof of the tunnel, which will provide shade for the plants that when it gets really warm in the summer need a bit of protection.
My favourite bit of the polytunnel, before we go and just finish on talking about the community day, is the fact that the unexpected irrigation system that we've got that flowing through it.
Yeah, one of the interesting consequences of the tunnel has been the fact that we do have this stream that's appeared. And I think at this time of year, the problem is our soil just gets so saturated that the water's got nowhere to go. And so instead, it's just flowing gently through the tunnel and then condensing on the roof and happily watering the plants there. The slight challenge is it's a bit like getting into a bog to get into the tunnel. So we've just stuck loads of wood chip down and hopefully that'll save the day and stop us being up to our knees in mud every time we need to pick a Asian green.
Basically, you've created your own climate.
Yeah, I can see that.
And, you know, wood chip solves everything.
It does.
So in terms of the activities as well, we used the Grange Hub where people came and it was a great place to kind of retreat to. We had rest, we had cups of tea, coffees, cakes, beautiful lunch that you've made, Chloe, from the produce of the market garden. And we planted a few hundred trees and created brush piles, fixed and did some TLC to some of the hedgerows that we planted last year, and also started work on the wood meadow, didn't we? So pretty busy day.
It was great. And it's really lovely to see the differences in the wood meadow. Now the trees have started to go in. It's really exciting. I can't wait to see how that develops over the next few years.
As long as we can keep the deer off it. I mean, more of a fatwa against them recently as well.
Yeah, there has been quite a lot of deer around. Definitely one of the biggest challenges for us in terms of tree planting is the number of deer and their preference for our newly planted saplings.
Not just newly planted. I mean, there's some kind of 5 to 10 year old oak saplings, kind of post saplings, adolescents, and on the project, which I absolutely love, and I walk past regularly, and I'm just seeing the branches get torn and mangled and ripped and bent, and we don't have any large grazing herbivores apart from the deer. So it's just fascinating the negative and detrimental impact that these beautiful creatures have on our landscape, invasive species anyway, majority of them.
well, we just need to get the wolves and the bears and then we'll be all sorted.
We should not be talking about that on an episode about farming, Chloe. So
that is true. Yeah, and maybe not the wolves. I don't think bears eat deer, actually. It's the lynx we eat, not the wolves.
Moving on. So, I mean, is that it? Should we move on to the interview?
I think so.
So like we said at the top, Claire Hill is a farmer, an educator and a pioneer. Basically, I mean, I think like a half farmer, half cool mad scientist doing some awesome stuff to push forward the realms of regenerative agriculture, which we'll get into. She actually came to site here. She walked around and she actually gave us some great advice around bringing on board our own kind of cattle, how best to manage them, the kind of impact they can have, the numbers we should have. And while she's here, we took the opportunity to interview her to get her to share her wisdom with you, lovely Wilder podcast audience.
I think what stands out in this conversation is just the breadth of topics we cover. We explore everything from the definition of regenerative agriculture, the impacts of industrial farming, and essentially how do we shift a paradigm? How do we help people take on board a more regenerative mindset, as well as getting into the experiments that are occurring on Plankton Farm, like the dual purpose chicken and the wood pasture with the cattle.
Claire, welcome to the Wilder podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, thank you very much for your time. You've been very generous with your time. The listeners would like to know, but you've been to the project. You've had a good look around and we spent most of the day you educating us on your area of passion and expertise. Would you mind giving us a bit of introduction to yourself and what you find yourself doing now?
Yes. So my passion and expertise on grazing livestock, I think. But so where I've come from today is our farm, 80-acre farm, Plankton Farm in Shropshire, where we are livestock and perennial agriculture is what we call it. So mostly trees and perennial vegetables, plus cattle and chickens, both for laying hens and meat. I came to that farm through a background in the food industry, working for the National Farmers Union, for the Red Tractor logo, for Sainsbury's in their agriculture team, and latterly FAI Farms, which is a sustainability consultancy facing into food corporate businesses. I discovered regenerative agriculture in about 2019, and that changed my perspective about how we grow food and really, in the end, how we do everything and how we live our lives. And that led me to then want to have somewhere to pursue and work out the art of what's possible when it comes to regenerative agriculture and livestock farming. So that's why I ended up at Plankton Farm.
I'm really surprised that it's only been since 2018 that you've been immersed in the world of regenerative agriculture, because you're such a prominent figure, I would say, in lots of ways in the world, in the space. What led to that discovery?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I just started to find that things weren't working. So I was running the farm that FAI have, which is a 1,200-acre farm owned by Oxford University, run by FAI. And it's about the research and working out new ways of doing things, historically focused around animal welfare. But what we found was we'd gone from it floods once every 10 years to it floods every year. Half the farm goes underwater for multiple times every year. So the way in which we'd farmed it previously just wasn't working anymore. And that made me start to question, like, this, it can't be this hard to grow food. It's like the most fundamental thing that we need. And this is breaking everybody. And something's not right. Something's not working. And that led me to think about looking for something else.
And so when you went looking for something else, was it with a clear vision in mind? You know, you learnt and you wanted to do it yourself to prove it could be done? Or was it more a journey of, I know there should be a better way, I want to research and find what that looks like?
No, it was kind of like because I'd been very committed to the way we did things, and I thought that what we needed was more research and more data, and if we could just collect more data, it would get better. So then I started to, I was like, all right, but we're collecting all this data and we're doing all this stuff and it's not, we're getting these like mild improvements, but at the same time as maybe we're getting slightly better growth rates on our lambs because of the changing climate and the fact that we've all used lots of wormers in farming for a long time, we've got resistance to wormers. And so like we're getting these little steps forward, but there's always something else pulling us back. And then maybe someone might mention Pasture for Life, where basically animals are certified having never eaten any grain. And I was thinking, well, that's not possible. We can't do that. But then I was like, well, maybe it is possible. And so it came like these little things kind of like, once I opened my mind, what do they say? When you change what you see changes. And that's what happened for me. Then things kept falling in front of me that started to make sense.
And it was for us as well, is visiting your farm was a really exciting day, help for Chloe and I, because we just, you know, we're going through a similar journey albeit from a different perspective and angle. And, you know, coming to see you doing things differently, evidencing it, has been a huge eye-opener for us, which is why we've been trying to get this podcast for quite a while now. Let's take things back. Would you mind, for the listeners, and as also for me, as listeners know, I'm, you know, I always helps for a recap. What is meant by regenerative farming when you say that?
Yeah, so it's one of those words that we don't know what it means. There isn't an easy definition. And I guess the way that I like to explain it is it's any kind of farming system or growing food where we are regenerating, whether that is the soil, the water, the way the soil holds onto the water, the people that are working within that system. And because regeneration is the opposite to degradation. And unfortunately, particularly since the Industrial Revolution and the Second World War, our food system has produced loads of volume of food, but the unintended consequence of that has been the degradation of our soil health and our biodiversity. So it's about a farming system that puts those things back. But that can be done in hundreds and thousands of different ways. So there is no, like, if you do this one thing, it will be a regenerative system.
And that does bring me on to, again, another stupid question from me. But what is the difference between regenerative farming and organic farming?
Yeah, good question. And they are, in some cases, similar. So there are some regenerative farms that are also certified organic. Mm-hmm. And becoming certified organic tends to mean a couple of key things. One is the absence or no use of chemical fertilizers and pesticides, and also lower stocking rates for livestock. So livestock have more space to live, and restrictions, of course, around numbers of animals and things. And so some regenerative farms are certified organic, but there are some organic farms that are still maybe farming in a way where their soil health is degrading over time. We'd like to think that it's not, but equally, if you're ploughing a lot and doing a lot of cultivations to stay on top of your weeds because you're not allowed to use the chemicals, which is right, but those techniques can erode soil health over time. So I think we're kind of learning now that two things go hand in hand, but one doesn't necessarily mean the other.
I think that's really interesting, and perhaps one of the challenges for the world of regenerative farming that it doesn't currently have a certification in the way that organic does. And I hear there are limitations of that in terms of sometimes the practices that are being adopted to reach that certification aren't necessarily regenerative. But then that does create a challenge for people and understanding as a consumer, what am I eating? And it's come from a regenerative system. What does that even mean? And how can I be confident that it is actually improving the landscape of which the land is being farmed as opposed to degrading it?
Yeah. And I just to add to that, I think the question is how do you, because there is no certification for regenerative farming, how do you stop from just being used as a marketing ploy or marketing angle for someone who isn't actually using the correct practices?
It's a real challenge and a real pressing challenge. I mean, one thing that's been really good is the Advertising Standards Agency have actually brought in some specific regulation around the term regenerative farming, which is really helpful. So if anybody feels like it's been misused, it can actually be reported and dealt with. But we don't really want to go down that route. There is a challenge because it's such a catch-all term. So if someone's doing something slightly differently, like they're using a little bit less chemical, they're now sometimes using that term regenerative to describe that. I think one good thing is lots of people are talking about it now, but maybe they weren't before, which is another route into curiosity about how our food is grown. And I think the question, as all of us as individuals can hold, is asking that question of the person we're buying it from, is what is it regenerating? Because ultimately, people sometimes use the term regen ag or regenerative farming, and it sometimes, I think, gets a bit lost from the point about it is about regenerating something. So as soon as you ask, what has this regenerated? What are you regenerating as part of your thinking on this? Then that's kind of helps to sort the wheat from the chaff.
So the three of us sat around this table here now chatting away. We've already kind of drank the Kool-Aid, and we know that and believe and understand the value and the benefit of regenerative agriculture. But for our listeners that are listening, that maybe if this is a new term to them, can you explain why you or we believe there's a need for regenerative agriculture, and what is wrong, if that's the right phrase, with the more traditional methods?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a challenging question.
That's okay. It's keeping it succinct, I think, is the challenge. It's so since the Second World War, where there was a food shortages, the government incentivized farmers massively to produce volumes of food. And that was really important. And it was the right thing to do at the time. And at the same time, there was a rise in the use of chemical fertilizers. A nitrogen fertilizer came to the market, became easily accessible for farmers, and it helped grow a lot more volume of food. The unintended consequences of that push for volume only is that we've lost the quality in our food, the nutritional density. So you have to eat something like 7 carrots today to get the iron and magnesium from a carrot, compared to somebody in the 1940s would have to eat carrots. Yeah. So by making everything grow quicker and faster and relying on artificial inputs to do that rather than natural soil health, we've actually degraded the quality of our food. So that's something. And then we've got lots of issues we know, around diet-related disease and all of those things. And also that volume has created, often we've gone down a route of monocultures. So we grow a lot of, a handful, I think, in the world. We really rely on kind of 5 grains when really there are hundreds. So we've got these monocultures, and then we tend to put those into some ultra processed foods and things like that. And then what we've got is, as everything's got bigger and greater, we've got kind of like quite a lot of corporate control in our food system. And as citizens and as farmers, we're like small players and possibly the ones that are losing out in some cases. So we've got these kind of multiple factors, and also our climate is changing and becoming a bit more volatile, and that is all affecting on our ability to grow food.
Mm-hmm.
So as we've grown more and more volume of food, we haven't been replenishing soil health at the same rate. So we've almost got this extractive system where we're taking out more than we're putting back. Mm-hmm. And that can only carry on for so long. And we've had a good block of 80 years or whatever of doing that. But now we're finding that we're having to put on more and more fertilizers to grow things, or we're having to give animals more and more treatments to keep them healthy. And that is, can't continue indefinitely. And we're starting to realize now that we've unintentionally degraded quite a lot of our land. We know, for example, biodiversity wise, I know you'll know this and your listeners will, but it's really sad to say that we're one of the most nature depleted countries in the world. The farmland birds have had absolutely massive declines, even in my lifetime. And that my children don't recognize my son, when he looks on Google Maps and he sees the river and he says, "That's not blue. Water's not blue. Water's brown." And I think, wow, that's massive, isn't it? And so we none of us got up and decided that we were going to farm in a way that sucked everything out. We were following what we thought was the right thing to do. And now we're realizing we need to pivot and we need to change and we need to start putting some of that back.
So given that context and the recognition of those, I suppose in systems thinking, we talk about the kind of second order effects, the things that you don't necessarily predict are going to happen from your first intention, which is to perhaps grow more food or make food more accessible, or whether people were considering when you set up these systems. When we think about regenerative agriculture, we're obviously trying to be curious about the effects as a whole. So what are the improvements that you might see from within a regenerative agriculture system?
So the improvements that we see at farm level is an increase in the biology of the soil. So there's more life in the soil. For every teaspoon of soil, there's more microorganisms than there are people on this planet in a healthy soil. So there's so much that the soil does, and so much that we still don't even know about it. Most soil scientists would agree. But what we know is the more life, the better. We then have more interaction between all the different roots, and the plants themselves grow healthier and stronger. They're not so susceptible to disease, so that we don't need to use so much protection for them artificially. And overall, we can grow an abundance of food. If we think about the Amazon, or an untouched area by human hand, more biomass, more stuff grows in that 1 square meter than any human designed food system. And so it's trying to take some of the principles of thinking about the health of the soil and how we can use that to grow food.
And isn't that so critical, isn't it, that we start with the soil? Because from the soil comes everything, really, in terms of the crops are growing, the grass that the animals are grazing on. And then from that, I suppose the well-being of the whole system, including the people that are involved in that. So beyond the soil health, what are the other benefits that you might see from a regenerative system?
We're seeing more nutrient-dense food being grown. And then when people and when farmers start to think in a regenerative way, they start to see their farm differently. So they might see that, oh, actually, some of the trees that we used to have here were really useful for extra browse. That's as in food for the cattle to eat, plus shade and shelter. So then you get healthier animals because they've got a more diverse ecosystem that they're creating on their farm.
And am I right in thinking that a more traditional farming method is about output? So it's what do we need to put into the ground to make as much yield as possible? But that's quite expensive because you have to put a lot of chemicals on or fertilizer, and therefore those gains in output are outweighed by the cost of the stuff you've got to input. And is it different for a regenerative farming system?
Yeah, so that model of kind of, yeah, putting the maximum in to get the maximum out, you know, it has worked very well for people, but we sort of hit a bit of a ceiling with it now. And the cost of inputs have come up at the same time. So the yield rate is not continually ever growing. Mm-hmm. And the cost of the inputs, the fertilizer and the pesticides, has increased massively over recent years too. Mm-hmm. So the margin within that is eroded away. And that is one reason why some people are looking to regenerative agriculture from a financial perspective, as like, how can I continue my farm as a profitable business or bring it back into profitability, often even coming from that angle.
And that brings me quite nicely onto my next thoughts, which is around mindset and culture change. Again, us sitting around here, knowing what we know about climate change and the polycrisis and biodiversity loss and all those bad things, why aren't more people doing regenerative agriculture if it makes sense in pretty much every way possible?
Yeah, I think if you haven't farmed it from the outsider, it totally makes sense. But a lot of the techniques that we might use in regenerative agriculture, at times they're like the counter opposite to what we've been taught. So the model of like yield being the most important thing. So the more you get out, that's your badge of success as a farmer. If you've got a high wheat yield or you've got lots of a high number of litres per cow, you know, those are the sort of things that people pride their work on. And there's a culture around production which came from, you know, it's come out of this kind of rise out of the Second World War. And that's what everybody's like, a badge of honor. So we're not just saying change this technique, we're changing a culture. We're saying actually now it's okay. A wild farm, a wild looking farm, where it in many people's minds looks messy, that's the biodiversity habitats that we've lost. So actually we need to put that messiness back. But when even some of the supermarkets have scores that, you know, is it neat and tidy when you approach the farm, you know, and you get scored down if you maybe had messy hedges or things like that. So we've created this farming culture around neatness and tidiness, which is totally the opposite to what nature needs. So then you're asking farmers to do almost the opposite to what they've done. And that's why it's not just a case of saying, do this new technique instead of this one. This is about shifting a culture of people to see things differently.
It's really interesting, and whenever we talk about shifting culture and mindset, it sounds easy, but it's inevitably incredibly challenging. And it's particularly challenging when people feel stressed and anxious. And as a general rule, the population as a whole is more stressed and anxious than we have ever been. And I think the dominant stories I'm hearing from both talking to farming neighbours and from engaging with some of the sort of dominant stories that are being told in the media is that farmers as a general profession are really struggling. So we're also asking a group of people that are barely coping on a day-to-day basis to shift their mindset, which is hard to do even when you're feeling resourced and resilient.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's there's the pressure of weather patterns changing, there's the financial pressure, and then there's that pressure of, you know, farmers seem to get the blame for a lot of things that are problems. So yes, we have not great quality in our rivers anymore, you know, like we don't, and agriculture is in part, has a part to play in that. But then everybody seems to go, oh, it's the farmer's fault, rather than what has the system done that we've created, that we've made the margins so tight in food. Who's really making the money, so that farmers are having to do things that sometimes mean that pollution is happening in rivers. And then the farmer blame goes at the farmer level, not in the corporate businesses that are really controlling our food system. If we really look at it, there's not very many players there anymore. And I think that is something that's really hard. So it feels like you're coming at it from this place of everyone wants me to change, but they're also criticizing everything I do.
Yeah, that's so true. I've not yet met a farmer who says, oh, I love polluting the stream and I'm so happy that I'm killing biodiversity. That's quite the opposite. You know, when I spend my time with our neighbours, you can tell the love and the affection they have for their animals, their livestock, their surroundings, the pride that they have. And it's always good to get farmers on, people like yourself, to talk about this, because it is very, very hard to see things from other people's perspective, and especially farming, because it's such a closed world in lots of ways. Unless you are a farmer and you're surrounded by it 24/7, it's a hard thing to penetrate the psyche, the mindset, or the challenges and the pressures that's upon them.
And when, again, we're thinking about mindset shift, often what people want when they're stressed and anxious is a quick solution. If I do this, then I'll get that kind of input output system, which when we're struggling, we want the simplicity of that. But I've heard you talk a number of times about regenerative agriculture being a mindset shift. And I suppose I wonder whether you could talk to that slightly. What we're talking about is helping people to open their minds to a different way of being and why that's important, as opposed to just if you do these 10 checklists on your farm, then you will be farming in a regenerative way.
Every farm is so different. Every farmer is so different. And we talk about that and we say every context is different. And I think what has come up in agriculture over recent years is these kind of like simple single solutions. So you plant this variety of wheat, you use this pre-emergent herbicide, you use all of these different things, and you will get a good crop of wheat out the other end. And that's been a reliable way of doing it. But it's taken into account nothing about how that individual person wants to be on that land, what that the geology of that land, what was there, what wildlife is there, and everything else. So what we are trying to do in what I work in regenerative agriculture is sort of helping farmers regain their own eco-literacy to sort of take that decision-making back to the, what they know about their farm and doing the right things for them and their farm and the livestock that they've got. And, you know, some farmers absolutely love working 7 days a week and never want to have a holiday and they want absolutely the most money out of it. And others might enjoy the lifestyle and they might want to take their children on holiday. They might want to have weekends off. We have this kind of badge of honour in agriculture. If you've, you know, never been to London or never had a weekend off, you're a good farmer. You know, like, so it's those types of things. And then they really affect how you might want to manage your land. And I think you're right about what you said, Tom, about talking to, no one knows about farmland birds more than farmers. And nobody knows really how it's all got to the point where we don't see them anymore. But everyone's really tuned in to kind of wanting to put it back. But it's working out how best to do that on each individual farm. So there is no like one solution for the whole country to just do something. Everyone needs to do their own bit.
And that brings us nicely on to one of the ways in which you're trying to do that and influencing beyond your farm. So could you tell us a bit more about Roots to Regeneration and the, what you're trying to achieve with it and the kind of people and participants you have as part of your course?
Yeah, so Roots to Regeneration is born out of a few things, really. But one was getting into regenerative agriculture myself and starting to see it as a solution. And then I needed someone to teach me how to do it. So I found Caroline, who I now co-founded it with, and she taught me how to do it differently. So, okay, so we need to graze the animals differently. How do I do that? What do I need to consider? And she's taught me that, and I've learned a lot along the way. And a lot of it is about being the changes. It's not been the technical thing. It's been the people around me. So the landlord saying, oh, the farm doesn't look good anymore. It's not neat and tidy. What are you doing wrong? And coaching me through how to deal with those things and how to explain what we're doing differently. And so part of it was like, well, if I've had these problems changing and I've got support around me, then how hard must it be for somebody else?
Mm-hmm.
And then we've seen the rise of things like Groundswell Agriculture Festival, where people are going along, getting really inspired for a day or 2 days, learning new things about how to do things differently and to regenerate more on their farms. But when you go back home and then try to slot the couple of new techniques that you've seen in the sessions you went to back into your existing farming system, often it doesn't work because it needs a kind of system approach. So we saw people kind of trying to make changes, but struggling. And so we thought about how can we support that? So it's a 2-year program for people doing kind of a deep transition, regenerative transition process. But really what we help people do is what we're talking about, stand back, design a regenerative system that's right for them, and then start to implement it on their farm. And the other thing that we Roost Regeneration does is it has farmers, but it also, we have about 50% of our cohorts are farmers. But the other thing, because of our work with the food industry that we saw really early on, is that it's not just about farmers making changes. Like, this is a system-wide change. So the food system around it, the veterinary support, the agronomy, the people buying the food, the supermarkets, everyone needs to understand what it takes for a system to regenerate. So about 50% of the participants that go through the program are also professionals in and around the food and farming industry as well.
I think there's so much value in that intention of how you structured the course and how you're helping people go on that journey of understanding the system as a whole and the importance of understanding principles before you can then start to apply methods, which is what you've just been talking about us. We've been talking about grazing management here on the site, and that's come up in the conversation. And I was really privileged that I went to a workshop with you a few weeks ago at the March's Real Food and Farming Conference. One of your recent graduates was talking about her experience of being part of the cohort. And what I was really struck by is it wasn't just about the changes that have happened on her farm, but it's about the changes that happened to her confidence, in her social relationships, in her purpose, her sense of what she was doing and why felt so clear from her descriptions, and the journey that the course supported, the development it supported in that way.
I think there's a lot of connection between your course and the Embercombe Rewilding course in terms of building a cohort to do it with and not feeling alone and having someone to ask and to enjoy the journey with. I mean, a very small example of that is Chloe went away on for a presentation somewhere and came back absolutely convinced we needed a wood meadow. But because I hadn't been on that course, the work required to bring me on the journey and to convince it's something that we should do on the land and get support from myself was a lot harder than it would have been if I was with her. And I just think it's about making sure the system around the individuals that go through this understand it, and therefore it will make it a heck of a lot easier for these people. Am I right in thinking that applications are open for the course?
Yeah, that's right. We run one cohort a year of up to 20 people. Yeah, applications are open at the moment. If you just Google Roots to Regeneration, we've got a landing page with all the information on, and the cohort starts in March and runs for 2 years.
Yeah, Chloe's been like, can I get on this? How do I get on this? But the link will also be in the show notes, so don't worry. So one of the major reasons why we came to visit your farm was because as we were going through our journey, we originally, you know, we were on this journey of transitioning to less meat and knowing where the meat comes from. And at the time, we were learning about cows, and you know, it's very easy to connect cows with global warming and methane. So we were really interested to try and explore, well, can you actually farm beef or cattle in line with nature, as opposed to it just being the reason why we're the temperature's rising? So that was why we came to meet you. So how's that going?
We have herd of cattle on the farm. Mm-hmm. We call them the engine of the farm because they're the sort of biodiversity powerhouse that go round and create. They're eating some grass, they're eating some trees, they're trampling, but then that grass and trees are regenerating and growing even stronger. I mean, I'm one of those, maybe I'm a bit of a rare voice in the farming industry to say that I also think we should eat less meat. And that's often not, it doesn't go down very well to my peers, but less and better. Like, absolutely. I just don't think that can be denied now. But there's not a case of no cattle ever, or, you know, grazing ruminants. The reason we use cattle to say that although the common modern breeds that we have today, even the native ones, are a long way from maybe what used to roam when it was more wild, but you know, from the auroch and things, they're the most relevant animal that we have today. Because grass co-evolved with grazing animals, it's not a separate thing. It can't defoliate, it can't take its leaves away like a tree sheds its leaves in the winter. Mm-hmm. Grass doesn't do that. It needs an animal impact in order to help it grow and regenerate and reseed and all of those things. So for me, they're kind of our ecosystem engineers around the farm. Mm-hmm. And the great thing that we get out of that at the end is really nutrient dense, super healthy, tasty beef that we can all then connect with. Mm-hmm. That system from.
And could you just take a second, how big is your farm and how many things being farmed conventionally, and how many cattle would you have on that area, and how big is your herd now?
So we have, our total herd is about 23 animals. That includes the cows, the bull, the young animals, the ones that are finishing, which is really small. And we're on 80 acres, which again is a small farm. I think we're up to 200 and something is the average farm size in the UK. And so if we were to just have cows on it and we were just cattle farmers, probably what we would do, we'd have a lot more cows, but we'd just graze them outside during the summer, probably 5-6 months of the year, if not a bit more. They'd be in sheds and then we'd be feeding them bought in grain, maybe a bit of silage that we might make ourselves. So we'd have a lot more animals, but we would be using a lot more ghost acres, is what we call it. So acres that we're having to grow elsewhere in the world or in the country to bring onto our farm to make our farm look like it's growing more. So we have fewer cattle, but the way that we do bring about the profitability side is by layering in other enterprises on top of that. So the chickens being a key one for us, and trees. We've got a lot of productive trees across the farm to layer things in that don't take away from the cattle grazing, but they add more to the farm.
So would you be able to give us a little bit more detail about how you're managing the cattle at the farm? Because when we were there, I think it was almost a year ago now, there was a lot of planting happening in quite an interesting structure as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, so we've planted across a large area of our grazing. We're recreating wood pasture, which was how ecologists are kind of coming to understand how a lot of the UK actually was. So some dense tree areas and then a lot more open glades with scrub and trees. So we're recreating that. We've planted trees and we've planted scrub. And the way we've done the scrub is around the base of every tree, we've planted three hawthorn plants, which is what would act as nature's natural tree guard. We've guarded the trees for now, but in the future, we can take the guards away because they'll have the scrub. And then we've actually planted up scrubby clumps, so areas where we've just planted basically hedge plants, hawthorn, blackthorn, etc., to recreate scrubby areas. The benefit for the cattle is it's extra browse, so extra things for them to eat in the future, shade and shelter. But of course, scrub is one of the habitats that we've lost the most of in the UK. And so by bringing that in, we're bringing a lot more biodiversity and a lot more going on above and below the ground, which will all contribute to the system producing more.
And you were just allowing the cattle to free roam in amongst the planting, or is there a bit more management in the grazing approach?
So they free roam in the fact that they're up. We haven't fenced the trees off as such because we use these things called a cactus tree guard, which prevents the cattle being able to nibble the tree while it's young and allows it to establish. So that's important that the cows can kind of still get in and interact around them. And then we do use a process of grazing where we are using electric fences to keep cows in certain areas on certain days. And we move the fencing every day. So basically they get fresh grass every day. But it means that what they've just grazed gets rested straight away. So they're not in a field for a long, long period of time. So the cows get the benefit of fresh grass every day and the land or the soil gets the benefit of rest straight away, which allows regeneration.
And you mentioned as well about having chickens as part of the broader system. And I find that really interesting because poultry, if we're thinking about challenges to the environment, are often really criticized in terms of the amount of waste and manure that's produced from the chicken farms. And, you know, we're very close, we're part of the River Wye catchment here. That's been in the news very recently, hasn't it, about a big lawsuit that's coming against the big chicken producers in the Wye catchment and the impact it's having. So is it, how do we have chickens in a regenerative system and how possible is it?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're exploring, really. Definitely there are people doing what they call pastured poultry. So chickens in small mobile sheds, and those sheds move around the farm. So there is no one area where lots of manure is landing because, yeah, chicken manure is quite high in phosphates and that's not very easily absorbed by the soil. And also with chicken, we've also got this polar opposites where we've got really small scale pasture poultry. And then, of course, our biggest producers are doing, I was speaking to someone the other day, you know, 1.2 million birds every 8 weeks on his farms.
What?
So, but that is because of us as a society have an insatiable demand for chicken, you know, and that is the reality of cheap chicken. We are, yeah, what we're really interested in exploring is what, you know, what does chicken look like in a regenerative system? How does it contribute to, how can chicken contribute to regeneration? Chicken are not native. They come from the red jungle fowl, which is an Asian bird. So there's also, when we look at it in the UK, what should we be eating? Probably geese, ducks, swans, maybe. But, you know, those waterfowl are native poultry and chickens aren't. So there's lots of questions to ask and hence why there's quite a lot of problems.
So what are some of the things that you need to hold in mind? If we're thinking about a holistic systems perspective about the role that chickens play and then how can we help them play a regenerative role in a broader system?
A fundamental thing to start with is that what we've done with our current chicken industry is we have laying hens and we have meat chickens. So we've got two separate, they're almost two separate animals now, two separate birds. And of course, in nature, that's never the case. And so you have laying hens that are incredibly good at laying lots of eggs, but they hold no body weight because they've been genetically selected to put all their energy into laying eggs, which makes sense. We want lots of eggs. We all like eating eggs, right? Makes sense. But that actually means that the males that are hatched, 50% of hatch are male, of course, because that's nature. There's no purpose for them because they lay down no meat. So unfortunately, they're culled at day old. And that is something that we have created in our system. And that would be true of all the eggs we eat today. And on the counter to that, on the meat production side of things, we've got birds that lay down so much meat so quickly, they go from hatching and yellow chick to finished bird on in a restaurant or, you know, in the supermarket in about 35 days.
Wow.
And that inherently has problems because effectively you've got an adult body weight on a juvenile frame of bones, and they have sore legs, they have sore feet, there's issues with heart attacks and other things. And so, you know, that is a challenge, but we've created this cheap chicken. So we've got these two polar opposite things. And then what it means, we've got a lack of resilience in the system. We get problems with disease. We're relying on incredibly high energy feed, which mostly is coming from soya from South America. Mm-hmm. That is, as well as bringing that feed in, it's an importation of nutrients. So once the birds have processed it and the manure is created, now we've got all this manure that we need to get rid of. We spread it on the land. The soil can't absorb it, and it's going into the river Wye and other rivers.
I had never thought of it from that perspective. That's fascinating, that importing of nutrients and a complete imbalance. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, if nothing else, it's a huge nutrient imbalance. Yeah, basically. And that nutrient has got to go somewhere, and it's going into the rivers, unfortunately, at the moment.
And is that necessary for chickens to have that amount of nutrients? Is that in order to produce eggs? Do they have to have all this imported grain, or is it possible to have a chicken on a purely grass-based system?
So in the wild, chickens would eat. They're woodland edge living. Red jungle fowl would live in the woodland edge. So they would be eating insects, small mammals, seeds, worms, you know, that sort of thing, plus some grazing on grass and things. And they might lay an egg every week or every 2 weeks. Of course, we, in the current way the food system is framed, we need a kind of an egg a day, really, from a chicken to make it work. So a chicken couldn't survive just on like grass system. And so it's that balance of productivity of, you know, we need more eggs, but maybe we could feed them a bit less. But that comes down then to the type of bird or the breed or the genetics that we're using. So that's what we're looking at. How can we get a bird that's much more resilient, that lays enough eggs? You know, what is it? It's enough, isn't it? We all just need enough. Mm-hmm. Don't need all this excess in loads of facets of our lives. So what's enough? You know, enough eggs, and to lay down enough meat so that the males from that system don't have to be culled. They can grow on to be meat birds. And the females, when they've laid enough eggs, or, you know, they've got to the end of their laying part of their life, that they have enough meat on them too, that we can make use of those as a food resource too.
And how far off do you think we are of achieving the breeding to get to that point?
So we've had some funding to look at it. We're just getting some more to look at a few more breeds. We're starting to get our heads around what we think that system, where it would work well. And that would be, think with the male, with the birds, the males finishing at about 16 weeks compared to currently 4 weeks for a kind of classic supermarket bird or 12 weeks for an organic bird as we currently stand. So it's a few more weeks on, but they, anecdotally, they're eating each day, they're eating a little bit less, but of course they're around for longer. So we need to understand like how much more would it cost and what other benefits might they bring. So that's what we're kind of researching at the moment. Before we developed these breeds that we have today, we of course did have these much more dual purpose birds. And in some places, my colleague Annie, she went to China to look at this exact topic. And when she talked about dual purpose birds, they were like, what is that? Isn't it just a chicken?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a chicken. So we're just trying to get back to just a chicken.
10 minutes of this conversation and summed up by, let's take it back to a chicken.
Yeah.
So to try to bring those two topics together, so we've been talking about the cattle being the engines of the farm and the need for kind of holistic planning and thinking. What role do the chickens play in relationship to other aspects of the farm?
There's two, really. One is in relation to the cattle, whereby we try and get as much as possible so that the chickens go on an area where the cattle have already grazed. And then they're scratching through the dung and they're eating some of the fly eggs and spreading the dung around. We have to balance that with, we don't want them to eat all the dung beetles because they're the good guys. They're like the bees of the soil. But yeah, we're thinking about that. So then the one is not taking from the other, so that the chickens are adding more fertilization, more scratching action. They're pulling up dead grass. They're doing all these different things, which in turn will grow more grass for the cattle. But they're spreading all the manure around so that we haven't got the flies and the worms. So they've got these kind of like really lovely interconnected roles that they play. And the other with the chickens is in amongst the trees. So dealing with any, like eating any windfall, so we're not having to worry about disease or anything. And then also grazing. So commonly people are having to strim or do other things to keep grass down and run among newly planted trees. But for us, we have chickens. So they do the job perfectly for us.
And we are very excited for Project Chicken here next year, where we're planning to have some chickens as part of our orchard system for exactly that reason, and also to provide manure for the market garden. So it's thinking about those interconnections all the time. What benefits are they going to bring to the whole of the system?
So it looks like we're definitely coming to the end of this conversation. Thank you very much for your knowledge. My last question is more long term for you. What does the future look like for your farm? And then follow-on question is, what do you hope for the future of farming in general?
For our farm, it's like every year we're seeing this new abundance come from the way we're managing now, building rest periods in and managing it in a different way. So I'm just excited to see what we get each year that springs up that you don't see in other at the moment on other farms or around us. And I'm just really excited about that. And what more then that means what more enterprises we can bring. So we've got a lot more stuff coming from the hedgerows, and it's like, oh, what would eat that? Oh, goats would eat that. Maybe we can get goats. Like, I see that kind of like building, and that's coming through nature. Nature is providing that extra growth and abundance that we can then grow food from. And that feels like a really special place to be.
That's part of the journey. It's an adventure, isn't it? And when you're doing it in line with nature and it feels right, it's a wonderful journey to be part of. And finally, you know, it's almost an impossible question, but where do you hope or where do you think that farming is going in the future, and how long do you think it might take to get there?
Yeah, well, it feels like this kind of nature-based approach, it's almost like the fifth agricultural revolution, you know, that's unfolding. Maybe that combined with AI, possibly, I don't know, but just this increasing of eco-literacy on farms. And we're seeing momentum build all the time. And I would like to see it quicker, because ultimately, I think it makes people happier. The people doing the farming and the people eating the food. And I think that's that for me, that's a kind of a motivator among anything else. It's like, oh, life could be more easeful if you were able to move into farming more in this way.
I couldn't agree more. But on that note, as we just come to the end, if people do want to find your produce, where would you like to send them?
To our website. So we do UK mainland delivery for our meat, for our chicken, and for our beef. So www.plantandfarm.co.uk.
And the links will be in the show notes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The biggest thing for me that stood out, unsurprisingly being me, is the necessity of an entrepreneurial mindset when it comes to farming, and not, you know, farming in a new way. It's saying, okay, we're going to reduce this, we're going to change this, we're going to pivot this, we're going to have fewer livestock, but then how do we bolt on more? And that's a huge challenge. And you know, what I've learned throughout my entrepreneurial journey is that everyone likes to think themselves as an entrepreneur, or thinks that they can come up with their own next bazillion pound idea and go away and ride off into the sunset in a Ferrari. But true entrepreneurs, people that can actually come up with an idea, execute on it, and be successful with it, are very, very few and far between.
I completely agree. And I think perhaps to build on that, I was also struck by this, the need to go from, to borrow a phrase from Nate Higgins, to go from that kind of narrow boundary thinking of, I just need to produce as much food as possible, through to that really wide boundary picture of how we need to think about the impacts we're having on the nutrient density of the food, the biodiversity, corporate power, climate change, soil health, river pollution, to be able to hold all of those variables in mind and hold a really holistic system, it takes special people to be able to do that.
Yeah. And we've just got to make sure that, you know, farmers are so crucial to our country that we are giving them the tools and the opportunities to succeed and the incentives to succeed and have that wider angle lens.
Perhaps on the note, because I think this isn't actually something Claire mentioned, but it's something that really struck me when I first discovered it about 18 months ago, which is when we were actually in conversation with a volunteer who works for DEFRA in their carbon reduction team.
And so those are what DEFRA is?
The Department of Farming and Rural Affairs.
Say it with confidence.
Department of Farming and Rural Affairs.
Yes, okay, cool.
And I kind of naively thought when she talked about this role of reducing carbon on farms that she was just talking about driving a tractor around a bit less to use less diesel. I couldn't really think about what else was carbon intensive on farming. But now knowing that the role that fertilizer plays in terms of its a source of fossil fuels, and obviously deforestation from all the ghost acres that Claire talks about, it really underscores the importance of agriculture, not only with addressing our biodiversity crisis, but also helping us to address climate change.
And I just love that example that she gave about the chickens and the dual purpose chickens being just chickens. Just going back to just chickens, not trying to be overcomplicated or clever or think we're better than nature. Just go, that'll do. That's the right balance. Let's go forward with that.
I think what's really powerful whenever we have a conversation around agriculture or the food system is the opportunity that we as consumers can play in helping to transform that system. It's the one thing that we all do 3 times a day, mostly, is eat. So making the decisions about what we eat, where it comes from, and being thoughtful about the impacts of those choices is perhaps our little opportunity to communicate or send a message to the wider system about what's important to us.
So I'll close this out by having a bit of appreciation for how hard and how diligently Claire works. It is extremely hard to push against the tide and try and create change, positive change, when everyone else is suggesting let's keep situation as normal. So, you know, keep going, Claire. You're a massive inspiration. And if you, the listener, have been inspired by anything that she's done, then everything will be in the show notes, ranging from links to her website, so you can go and buy her meat, or links to Roots to Regeneration to have a look at her course. You're running out of time to get on it now, so have a quick look at it and send her a message if you're interested. Chloe, were you pretty much finished?
Yeah, I think so.
The final thing from me is, if you've enjoyed this podcast, there are two things you could do. Number one, share the episode on your socials if you think other people would benefit from it. Or number two, not mutually exclusive, you could then, at the end of this, when this finishes, you can go onto your podcasting app and just find The Wilder Podcast and rate and review it to allow it to go up the rankings, the greasy pole, and to let other people know that this podcast exists, and hopefully there's some value to be had from it.